The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. Today I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on January 9th, 2005 from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois on a very wintry Sunday afternoon. Been gone for a couple of weeks, had a couple of tape shows for you, but we're back live now for a while. And today we've got a terrific show. Some of you may remember that about 6 months ago we did a program on the commercialization of childhood with Susan Lynn, who had a book out at that time. And it was very popular with our listeners. And today we're very fortunate to have the author of a brand new book, Juliet Shore, the author of the new book, Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture, to join us today as our guest. Juliet Shore is the author also of the award-winning books, The Overworked American and The Overspent American. She's a professor of sociology at Boston College and an expert on consumerism, economics, and family studies. I should also add that she, as an economist, is comfortable talking about a whole range of popular economics issues, and I know would welcome any calls or questions on the whole range of what's going on with the economy today. So feel free to open up your questioning, listeners, if you wish, to a broad range of issues. But we will talk a lot today about the new book, Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture, which has just come out. Terrific reviews published by Scribner's. Juliet Shore, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you. My pleasure to join you.
Well, I appreciate your taking time off on a Sunday afternoon. I know you've got children, and this is not a time normally you want to be working, if you can help it. Let's talk a little bit about the book, Born to Buy. What is the situation today with marketing to kids? I think most people who are parents, I think, will intuitively or instantly get what you're talking about, but don't often think about it a great deal. And then people who don't have kids might not be especially aware of it. You know, what is the changing world of children's consumption?
Well, there's been an explosive growth in expenditures on advertising to kids, and it's happening very rapidly. In the last 5 years, for example, the growth has been fantastic. When I started researching this topic in 1999, most people put the total expenditures at about $2 billion a year. It's now over $15 billion. And so there's much more money being directed to advertising to children. And by this, I mean the 0 to 12 age range. This doesn't even account for the huge sums that go to the teen and young adult market. So that's one difference. Many more commercials, many more stations, of course, and so forth. The other big thing is that you see a huge explosion in where kids are being advertised to. So it's no longer just television, which used to be the dominant vehicle. In fact, TV advertising is now not even, doesn't account for a majority of expenditures. Companies are spending huge sums of money to advertise to kids in schools. They're advertising to them on the internet, on radio, advertising through cultural institutions like zoos and museums, in doctor's offices. Pretty much anywhere kids are, you will find advertisers now trying to get at them. Possible exception of religious institutions, although I'm starting to hear some anecdotes even of advertising coming through churches.
Now, this is a quantitative change then in the raw amount of advertising and qualitative in the sense that it's going to new venues. Is that a correct assessment?
Yeah. There are other qualitative aspects of change as well, which have to do with the ways in which kids are being targeted to. We can get into that if you want. So it's a revolution, really, in kids' marketing, because kids have become a very powerful market in terms of their own purchasing power and their ability to influence parents.
If this is such a great idea and it makes so much sense for marketers to do this, why the last 5 years? Why not in the 1940s or 1960s or 1880s, for that matter?
Well, before recently, and I would say, it had sort of been coming on even before the last 5 years, but it's really taken off. a couple of things. One is kids had very little influence on parental purchasing in the past. You know, they could nag for toys or, you know, a few small items that they purchased,
mm-hmm.
or that, you know, they were exclusively kids stuff. But the things kids bought tended to be cheap. Like toys were cheap, penny candy. I mean, you think about even some of the terminology associated with kids' consumption indicated sort of its cheapness. So that's one thing. There wasn't much money in it. Number two, parents didn't buy based on what kids told them. In the past, you had much more authoritarian parenting. You can think of the kid should be seen and not heard adage of the past. So there wasn't nearly as much point in advertising to kids because they didn't hold the purse strings. That's been a major change. You have parents who are much more willing to buy kids what they say they want and also to allow kids to have a voice in purchase of family items, whether we're talking about the whole market basket of food, and that's the number one commodity group advertised to kids is food, and it's all, you know, pretty much junk food. Even things that, if you're not in this world, will seem, wildly implausible. The idea that kids are weighing in on the purchase of the family car or what kind of computer the family gets or where the family goes on vacation or what hotel they stay at or what restaurants they go to. But, in fact, kids are becoming more and more influential in families on all of those items.
Go ahead, Juliet.
Yeah, the researchers have the market researchers have a lot of data to show the companies who make cars and hotels and so forth and the ad agencies, and they're listening to that data.
We're talking to Juliet Shore today, the author of the brand new book, Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. We welcome phone calls if you want to call in. The number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Juliet Shore is a popular economist, too, can take questions on a broad range of questions dealing with economy and politics. In fact, I first encountered your work, I think, 15 years or so ago when you were writing about popular economics issues for Z Magazine.
Yep.
And that's where I first became aware of your work. And then since then, you've gone on to considerable acclaim with The Overworked American and The Overspent American. And now this book, it looks to be really, I think, one of the defining books in this, you know, area of concern, marketing to children, Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child, and the New Consumer Culture. So please do call in if you have questions or comments for Juliet Shore. And it's, again, any broad questions about political economy or economics are certainly welcome as well. The floor is open, so to speak. Well, let's talk about the content of these ads, too. TV ad specifically, but the messages in general. Is there a change in the nature of the sort of messages being communicated in this marketing to children?
Big changes. The first is that you've shifted from sort of straightforward messages to kids that say the product's great, you'll love it, which are oriented to the actual functional characteristics of the product. So that the candy tastes good, the toy is fun to play with, et cetera. To a world in which, as with adult marketing, the kids are being marketed with the symbolic meanings of products and a message which says, this product is cool, and if you have it, you'll be cool too. Without this product, you're a dork. This product will make you feel great, you know, as a person. So it will construct a good identity for you. This product will make you feel older than you are. And marketers have a wide belief that kids want to be older than they are, and so there's a lot of this marketing of what they call age aspirational. You know, the idea that kids aspire to be older. So you have a shift. The dominant theme in kids' marketing is the marketing of cool, and it has different dimensions to it. It's also been linked into this, what could be called ghetto marketing, which has been very common in teen marketing with athletic shoes, fashion, music, etc. The idea that the ghetto is the site of all things cool, and so companies that try to associate their products with sort of an inner city ghetto sensibility. And you also see that in kids marketing, in a slightly less edgy or sort of courting danger sort of way, which you get a bit more in the older kids marketing. But that idea that you need to be cool and you need the product to be cool is at the core of marketing, and it's a real shift from a sort of functionally oriented approach to kids to one which is much more insidious, because it's basically teaching kids that who they are depends on what they have, and that these products are, you know, not just that, oh, I want this because I want it because it's fun, but that something deeply fundamental is at stake, having to do with their very identity and self-worth.
How young are kids targeted now in marketing? I mean, where do they start saying, okay, now we can get after this kid? What age does marketing sort of really kick in?
Zero.
Zero?
Zero. I mean, it sounds incredible, but in fact, there is marketing to the infants. They have infant websites. There are the licensing of Pepsi-Cola licensed its logos to go on infant formula bottles. Really, by age one is when you get more of it, because that's, you've got kids television for 1 year olds, and you have tie-ins with fast food companies beginning with 1 year old TV. You have at age 18 months, market researchers showing that kids are identifying logos. By age two, you have widespread product requests by brand. And that's really the key, because all advertising is brand advertising. People don't advertise, for competitors' brands. They advertise for a particular brand. And so what they're trying to do is imprint those brands on kids' minds as early as possible and get kids to connect with the brands as soon as they are really, are able to talk and ask for those brands. And that's what parents are reporting is happening. So a lot of product requests at age two. At age three, the research is showing that kids are beginning to make those kinds of linkages that I was just talking about, that the brand reflects their identity, that the brand reflects their personality, so they're coming to emotionally connect with particular brands. Age three. It's incredible.
Yeah, it is. We're talking to Juliet Shore today, the author of the new book, Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on Media Matters, WILL, AM 580 in Urbana. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. Juliet Shore, what sort of research goes into this marketing? What role does research play, and what sort of issues do marketers want to research and know about children?
Well, here's another area where you've had a total revolution. In the past, children's marketing was a very low budget affair. As I said earlier, kids didn't have much money, and so companies didn't put a lot of money into researching them. Kids advertising was basically done by people who had kids, and they used their own kids. What their own kids liked, that's what they did. Well, now you have huge sums of money, and so they have to do a lot of research, and they're doing virtually every type of research that you can think of. They are doing standard stuff like focus groups and interviews. They're doing what we call ethnographic or naturalistic observation. I talk to a lot of researchers who literally follow kids around in stores, on the playground, who go into kids' homes. I interviewed market researchers who go into the bathroom with kids while they take baths to try and figure out their rituals to sell health and beauty aids to them. They watch every moment of, you know, eating, grooming, playing. They organize slumber parties for kids and observe what they do with them. There are enormous quantities of sort of surveys being done, thousands and thousands of surveys on kids. And the other really kind of very troubling area of research on kids is that they are starting to get into what's called neuromarketing, which is using the new brain science to figure out how to create powerful messages that kids won't be able to resist. And you're starting to see with adults, and I found one guy who's done it with teens and sort of a little bit below teenage kids doing MRI techniques on kids to watch what's happening to their brains as they see particular advertising messages. And what they're trying to do with those, that neuromarketing, is figure out how to create an ad that appeals to that pure emotional part of the brain, and where people cannot really activate the more rational and skeptical aspects. And one of the things we're learning from brain science, and something a lot of people have known for a long time intuitively, I think, is that kids are much less able to resist advertising than adults because that frontal cortex is not fully developed. That's what people think. So neuromarketing is a big growing area of research.
We're talking to Juliet Shore today, author of Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. Frankly, one of the more depressing books, but also one of the most important books that's been published in quite some time. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Bloomington, Illinois, line one, you're on the air with Juliet Shore.
Hi. I was listening to what you're saying, and one question that I had was, what's the role that parents play, you know, the kids being bombarded with all kinds of messages? What's it that the parents in the research you found were doing, and maybe what they need to do?
Yeah, it's a really key point. I would say there are a couple of aspects to it. You know, one is, what are parents doing? And I would say that for the most part, parents have been pretty open to the onslaught of advertising. And most parents haven't, I think, really understood how much is changing, the levels of exposure of the kids. Very few parents actually watch TV with their kids, despite what they say. They tend to be unaware of the intensive advertising going on in schools because they're not allowed into the schools for the most part. So a lot of this has happened without parents realizing it. I think you're beginning to get a little bit of a backlash to that. There are some parents who are very vigilant, and I interviewed parents for my book. I did find some who are very savvy about what's going on, and they do a lot to restrict their kids from seeing a lot of advertising. But for the most part, this has happened without parents paying a lot of attention. The debate that's going on between critics like myself and the industry is about the whether or not we need more than parental oversight and control here. Because what the industry says is, well, it's the parents' fault. If the kids are having problems because of all this, and we can get into that, what the effects of all this are. But it's because parents aren't doing their job. They're using the TV as a babysitter or so forth. It's a disingenuous argument because a lot of what the advertisers have been doing is trying to figure out how they can get around parents, advertise in places where the parents can't control, like the schools. That's a real appeal of the schools. But I think for the most part, you have parents who have not really stood up and said, this is wrong, stop this, you know, haven't pressured the government to do too much, haven't pressured the companies. And part of it is because many parents feel powerless in the onslaught of all this advertising. They feel like, well, the other parents are allowing it. It's everywhere. All you can really do is try and teach your kids to be a little bit savvy about it. But that's a message that I hear from parents a lot.
Juliet Shore, do you think
inevitability? Yeah.
Do you think, given that really the tsunami of marketing to kids that we're experiencing now? I mean, as a parent myself, I mean, the idea that you could extricate your children from this effectively without almost having to take a sabbatical from your job, go on a leave of absence, strikes me as making an awfully high demand on parents that parents of no other generation have had to face.
I agree with you. I mean, and that's why I argue in my book for collective intervention and, you know, more regulation on this and, you know, a variety of things, also prohibition of a variety of practices that are going on out there. It's way too much in too many places, in too many ways for parents to be able to effectively combat it. And you also have, you know, what we call in academia this collective action problem, which is that it requires a parent to, to keep a kid away from the advertising or to keep them out of some of these things. You really have to exclude them from the social world that they're growing up in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an unfair burden on the kids and the parents.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
You need a collective intervention. Now, not all of it is a state intervention. There are other types of social actions, I think, that can be effective. But the point is that consumption is a social process, and these are social values that the advertisers are trying to create. I mean, they're pretty pernicious social values, but I think what that means is we need a social response.
We're talking to Juliet Shore, the author of Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture, her brand new and very important book. She is a professor of sociology at Boston College, the author of numerous other works, including The Overworked American and The Overspent American. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a full bank of callers for you, Juliet Shore, so let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Cincinnati, Ohio, you're on the air.
Well, I'm glad I'm able to talk to you. I'm from Cincinnati. I went to University of Illinois a long, long time ago and lived in Chicago for a while. Then somehow I got a job in Cincinnati and wind up here. I'm working a little bit with the game industry, so I know I'm aware of a little bit of situation, how they develop games with their kids. My first question is dealing with the children's ad. You know, when I turn on the TV and try to watch your children's TV shows, I essentially get a headache because there's so many things just being bombarded. Why is that? I mean, why do they have such a small segmented messages and try to put so many in there?
Do you have more than one question, caller? Because if you do, why don't you give them all? Because we have a lot of people backed up.
Okay, yeah. And the other one is the game industry is start looking into advertising directly through the game itself and how that's going to affect. And have you is your book dealing with that?
Yeah. Well, let me take the second question first. That's called advergaming, and it's putting companies pay to put their a kind of product placement, their products placed into games, or you might have a whole game which is developed around a brand, and there is a lot of those on the internet. It started out with the free games, but now it's coming into the, you know, the more expensive, the marketed games that are being purchased, and it's a very appealing kind of advertising for the companies because kids spend so much time with those games. So if you can get your product into a game that a kid spends 2-3 hours a day watching, it means they're being exposed to your logo, your message, your marketing pitch. On the first question, there are two parts of it. One is that even though there are regulations for the number of commercials that the media can play in any unit of time in children's TV, which is unlike in adult, major companies have been violating those laws, and in fact, both Disney and Nickelodeon just agreed to pay substantial fines because they've been showing many more commercials than they are allowed by law. So that's one thing that's been happening, why you're seeing so many commercials. And the second thing is, with the bombardment issue, they believe that children crave sensory overload and that kind of fast-paced bombardment. It's one of the sort of tenets of received wisdom in the industry. And so that's their model of how to reach kids, and that's why you see that.
We're talking to Juliet Shore today on Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Ottawa, Illinois, you're on the air.
Hi. My question centers around children's desire to split away from the parents and individuate in the general collective society. And I just would like the author to comment on whether the children, in effect, are using the media and the advertising, or in the advertising using them as a way to break away from the parents and individuate, but they actually become a greater part of the collective media onslaught, maybe, to where they never really have a chance to develop outside of that sort of overwhelming, dominating advertising force. I don't know how else to put it. I just like your comment on that.
Yeah. Well, let me start by mentioning one of the big themes in children's advertising, and of course this has historically shown up in teen advertising. I call it anti-adultism, but you could also think of it as youth rebellion, or anti-adultism is the kind of perverted form of it that you get in the commercial, emanation. A lot of the sort of the definition of what's cool now in kids' consumer culture is what's cool is anti-adult. So it's dissing your parents, dissing your teachers, dissing authority. And that's a persistent theme. There's a kind of edginess or attitude towards it. You see it. You have certain brands which specialize in that. Nickelodeon, for example, and MTV, which are both Viacom products. They're very big in this anti-adultism. And so what's happening is that, again, based on the sort of research and the received wisdom of the field, they believe that kids will really resonate to that anti-adult message. And so they push that message a lot. One thing about it is that they're pushing it to really young kids now. So that you even have, in kids 5, 6, 7 years old watching programming, and even younger to some extent, which has that theme in it. Now, how does that connect with, a more sort of authentic desire to individuate? Well, one thing is that it's that desire, I think, is it typically doesn't happen in a big way for such young kids. And so there's a kind of perversion I'm not a big developmentalist in terms of how I understand kids, but to the extent that there is a developmental dimension to individuation, what the consumer culture is doing is sort of pushing down the ages at which that message is going out there, and I think that is confusing to kids in a lot of ways because they're at a really early age, the corporation is telling them, fight with your parents. I mean, one thing I found in the studies, the research that I did, is in the suburban kids who I studied, the more media exposure and what I call consumer involvement they had, the much more likely they were to fight with their parents, to disagree with their parents, to think their parents were uncool, to think their parents didn't understand that, to think their parents were a bore, because those are the messages that the consumer culture is giving them.
Julie, let me interject a question here if I can, because this really, you mentioned it earlier, and it really gets to the heart of the matter. What sense do you have? Can you sum up some sense of what the effects of all this are on children, especially, you know, 0 to 12, young kids, this commercial carpet bombing you're describing? I mean, what sort of social effects and psychological effects is it along these lines?
Well, I studied a variety of psychological, social kinds of outcomes. I tried to measure the whole, you know, get a measure of how a high level of consumer involvement in kids would affect them. And what I found is that the kids who get more sucked into consumer culture, who are more exposed to ads and media, are more likely to become depressed and anxious, more likely to have lower self-esteem, more likely to have psychosomatic conditions like frequency of headaches, frequency of stomach aches, frequent boredom. And as I said, also for in the suburban locale, what I found is that they had much poorer relations with their parents, more likely to fight with them and feel alienated from their parents. So that there's that whole set of things. You have another set of outcomes that other people have done a lot of research on, which are a little bit more in the medical public health area, where we know that the kids who are more exposed to the ads are more like, and the programs which contain the products, because it's not only the direct ads when you're talking about things like alcohol and tobacco, it's seeing them used in movies that turns out to be extremely powerful, but more likely to smoke, to drink alcohol, to have violent behavior, of course, to gain weight, eat junk food, and become obese. All of those things are related to marketing now.
So what sort of defense does the industry give when presented with this sort of information or these sort of points? What is the defense that not only this is just something the parents should worry about, but actually is there someone saying, hey, all this advertising to kids is good. This is really great.
Well, there are actually a few people saying that, but I don't think they're all that credible. The bigger line is, oh, we're actually powerless, and our ads are powerless, I mean, on some level. So, for example, if you look at the debate about smoking and drinking, their biggest one is they deny that they target kids, which is false. I mean, underage kids are exposed to more alcohol advertising than legal-age drinkers in this country. So they are targeting, they're very sophisticated about it, and it's hard to catch them with intentionality, but they say we don't affect the likelihood or the frequency of drinking and smoking, only the brand choices. But that's not true, and the research shows that's not true.
So there's really not a credible, in your view, a credible argument to defend this practice. There's no one putting forward a Magna Carta about how this is really something that's positive for our society.
No, you have a couple of people. Their arguments who say ads make kids more savvy, but that's a really fatuous argument. Actually, the research shows the opposite, which is kids who see more ads are less skeptical of ads.
Well, let's go back to the
less savvy.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Now we have some very patient callers. Line 2, Urbana. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Juliet Schor, author of Born to Buy: The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture.
Yeah, just a few comments, and then you can comment on them. The first one is the parents serving as the model have bought into this overconsumption themselves. I mean, extremely so when we look around. You know, the bigger houses, the bigger cars, but, you know, so they're in that whole process. The second one is that we have the frequency of the advertising, the same ads, which is repetition, which is actually a form of brainwashing when we look at it that way. And the third one, you were talking about doing something about it, which certainly should be done, but in our current environment of deregulation, of you know, corporations, which I think are not justified, mergers, acquisitions, and all that, it's going to be a very difficult thing to do.
All right.
Yeah. Well, let me take the first, which is that, you know, that the parents are suffering from the same disease that they're allowing to develop in their kids, and I think that's a really important point. There's a little bit of research which shows, you know, the more materialistic parents are, the more materialistic their kids are. That's something that I think, you know, you probably don't need research studies to see as well. And I think that is important in understanding why parents have tolerated as much of this as they have, even though they tend to be more critical of the advertising to kids. I mean, they, you know, because parents understand that kids are a lot more vulnerable to this advertising than adults are. But I think it's why parents have tolerated as much targeting of their kids as they have, which is that many of them are also caught up in this. Although, you know, it's also true that even for parents who are not, you know, in that very materialistic kind of rat race sort of world, because, you know, I heard from a lot of parents doing this research, and since the book has come out, you do have parents who are trying to live differently and are having a lot of trouble, you know, protecting their kids from this stuff. So it's not only the kids of materialistic parents who are getting targeted.
Well, let's turn to the question he raised, which is really at the core of your book at the end. It's the concluding chapter, which is, okay, what can we do about it exactly? What are the prospects of changing this? Is it pretty much hopeless?
Well, I don't think so. And I would like to, you know, shed a little light on the wonderful host of this program, Bob, who has shown that there are some issues in this country that you can actually get people fired up and organized about. And, of course, I'm talking here about media reform and scrutiny of what's going on with media, in which I think 5 years ago no one would have predicted the level of outrage, organization, and success that the movement for media reform has had. And I think this issue of kids and commercialism is another one where there's a lot of public sentiment that something rotten is happening. If you look at the public opinion polls of parents, most parents think there's way too much advertising going on. Even the marketers themselves, when you do polls that have been done of the marketers, think there's too much marketing being directed at kids. It's an issue that I think there's some broad resonance for, and we're beginning to see some successes which have started around junk food marketing in schools, and you now have a number of states which have been banning soft drink marketing. You have the city of Seattle, which has just banned all, not only junk food marketing, but junk food consumption in its schools. You have some bills which have been put in Congress which address junk food marketing in schools. So I think that's the sort of wedge issue where you are starting to see some effective mobilizing, organizing, and possibly even some regulation, although that's not happening at the federal level yet, but you're seeing it at state and local levels.
Is this a liberal versus conservative type issue from your experience?
To the contrary. It's a very interesting issue in that you have a lot of conservatives who are very critical of marketing. And you've seen some interesting coalitions on some fights, like Channel One, which is a commercial broadcast that goes out to 40% of middle and high school students in the United States, 2 minutes of commercials every day for junk food, military recruiting, violent movies, and so forth. Conservatives have been very active in trying to stop Channel One. They tend to be more focused on the issue of sexuality and sort of, you know, a kind of a junk culture. So the cultural values part of this. But it's interesting that it's one of the, I think, one of the issues out there where you really have a possibility of of reaching out across that whole political spectrum.
We're talking to Juliet Shore today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Juliet Shore is the author of the new book, Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. We have a full bank of phone lines. I promise I will get to all of you. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Juliet Shore.
Hi there.
Hi.
So the impact with advertising versus the kids' self-esteem doesn't really surprise me much at all, because by definition, advertising, there you can never possibly have bought enough stuff. I remember one, and then you get conflicting stuff as well. I remember one advertising campaign between two different mouthwashes, where one was if you used their mouthwash, you had soda pop breath, whereas if you used the other company's mouthwash, you had medicine breath. So no matter what you chose, you could not possibly get it right. So there's that. The other question I had was, given that product placement is becoming much more prevalent, given the advent of TiVo and DVRs and things like that, where I can skip the commercials, even though they've managed to outlaw a button that just says skip the commercial, I can just fast forward 30-second chunks and take 3 or 4 seconds to skip what used to take 6 minutes. So they're obviously trying to get around that. My overall question here is, as a parent, what can I do short of just locking my child in a room until they're 35? How can I, as an individual parent, protect my children from what's going on here?
Well, I think the first thing to start with is have them grow up, you know, pretty much television free if you can. That goes a long way toward screening out things. That's what I've done with my kids. I've been very, very happy about it, and I think it's worked really well. Second is to make sure you know what's going on in your children's schools and to try and fight advertising in the schools. And that's another area where, you know, it's a small enough environment that you're dealing with that you can actually have an impact, particularly if you, you know, organize with some other people. I think limiting their overall media exposure is also important. What my research finds is that the volume of media exposure matters. And, you know, the average kid in America's got 5.5 hours of media use a day, and that's higher in some age groups. As they get into that sort of late elementary, early middle school, it's even higher. So that's another thing, is to really keep control on that, to be careful about the content. So, you know, all movies are not alike, and some are more pernicious than others in terms of the amount of smoking and alcohol they're going to see in them, the amount of violence, gratuitous sexuality, and so forth. I also think that having a strong family and community life, which is not focused around consuming, helps a lot, and allows you to kind of give your kids something else. And there are certain realms. I noticed that music, for example, my kids are involved in classical music. It's a very uncommercialized type of activity. So that's another thing to do, is to try and get them into activities that are not so heavily commercialized. So they've got other things in life.
Okay, we're talking to Juliet Shore today. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Fort Worth, Texas, you're on the air with Juliet Shore.
Hello. You commented a little bit already on Channel 1. I was going to make a comment on that. I've done a little bit of substitute teaching at a local school district, and one of the things that they have is they really set aside, like, time in the homeroom. I think it's the homeroom period, and this was, I think, you know, sixth grade, and where they, you know, they watch these programs, and on that Channel 1, I don't know who owns Channel 1. I was curious what... what's the
Prime Media, the company that owns it is Prime Media. It was the original company, which was Chris Whittle's company, ended up having to sell it, and that's Henry Kravis. He's a big
the immortal
Kravis Kohlberg, Roger Kravis Kohlberg, something. Bob, you probably know.
Yeah, the junk bond guy.
Yeah, it's Prime Media is the company that now owns Channel One. They enter a contract with Channel One, by the terms of that contract, they must have those children watch that program every day for the entire school year.
Yeah, I actually turned it off, and the kids complained. It was kind of amazing. I turned it off during the advertisement, the straight advertisement. I mean, it's all advertisement, but they actually have, you know, things that you would see, promos for shows on, you know, TV and things like that. And I turned it off because I told them, you know, you're better off not having watched it, you know, than watching it. And some of the kids actually complained, but I thought that was kind of interesting. But another question I have is on DVDs. I find, you know, I have a 2-year-old. I don't let him watch any TV just because it's just more hassle than it's worth to try to keep up with it and, you know, to make sure he doesn't watch the advertisements and this and that. So I've gone to DVDs, but even in that, there are things that in the DVD format that you can't, they don't allow you to fast forward or skip or things like that. And I was wondering if, you know, some DVDs are better about this than others, and I was wondering if there's a site on the internet where you can find a listing of DVDs that are a little more friendly, you know, that don't have, you know, the ads in the very beginning or at the end or whatever. And I was curious what you thought, or do you know about that?
I don't know much. I would look for the nonprofit, you know, some which are educational or something where you would maybe find that. But any of the ones now made by the, you know, it's a teensy group of companies which dominate all kids' consumer culture. It's those big media giants. It's Disney and Viacom, AOL, Time Warner. They're just a few of them, and they're very commercial. Everything they do now is very commercial. PBS has also become extremely commercial. I mean, PBS is the network that brought us Teletubbies, which is TV for 1-year-olds. So you'll find previews and ads and stuff in pretty much all of those kinds of products, I think.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Juliet Shore.
Hello. My husband and I have a 6-month-old, and we're very concerned about a lot of the things that you're discussing today. One thing that we have tried to do is instruct the grandparents to not buy any character-driven toys. Now, some Winnie the Pooh stuff has, you know, slipped by, and that's okay, but I'm concerned about the marketization of some books diminishing the quality of such classics as the Winnie the Pooh books and Peter Rabbit, and I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah, well, what's happened is that these characters have been bought up by the biggies, and so they kind of revamp them and turn them into commodities. And Winnie, you know, the Disneyfication of Winnie the Pooh is the most famous example of that, I guess. And I think you're going to see it more and more as they search for more and more commodities as their own sources of creativity and imagination have really dried up because of that corporate domination of so much of the media world. You can try. There are also, though, a proliferation of small presses and, get the old original versions of things in the library and so forth would be probably the way I would deal with that if I were you.
I think there are also a number of online resources, like the earlier caller asked, and I don't have them off the tip of my fingers, but I'm sure they're there to assist parents to try to locate sort of non-commercial alternatives for children. And also to get them to participate in the battle to decommercialize as much of childhood as possible.
Yeah, there's some great. I mean, one of the people I've heard from since my book came out is the children's singer Rafi, for example, who's very, very concerned about commercialization and has done a lot. And you know, there are certain sort of niche markets of children's culture that are much less commercialized. Other of these independent singers, for example, kids singers. There's one out of New York, I think it's Dan Cohen, maybe is his name, who are, you know, also in their lyrics and in their the way they talk to kids and so forth, are trying to put forward a different decommercialized kind of vision.
We have 2 callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's try to see if we can squeeze them in. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Juliet Shore.
Hi, I just had a couple of comments. The first thing I wanted to do is recommend a video, and Ms. Shore, you may have been on this video. It's a few years old. It's called Affluenza, and it talks a lot about these issues. It's a really good video. I don't know if people can pick it up at the library or what, but it's a real, it talks about advertising to kids and things like that.
Yeah, well, just I am in there, and there's also Escape from Affluenza, and there's a great website, Affluenza website, and also a book now.
Oh, great. Okay, that was my first comment. The other comment, I rarely watch TV, but I did watch the other day. I'm a big Illinois fan. I watch the game on TV and was just appalled at the advertising. There was one advertising for a video game called Mercenaries, and it was just this violent game. It, you know, this guy gets on you, says, I shoot first and ask questions later, and it was just crazy. And so I was just in also watching the advertising during that game was amazed at how sexualized advertising has become, particularly women being so sexualized in advertising, and this has to affect kids too. So I just thought maybe you could comment on those things.
Yeah, we don't have much time left, and boy, that's an entire show. But let's give it a minute if you can, because it is one of the key themes of marketing now is the sexualization of childhood.
Yeah, all the way down to the littlest kids. You see it in fashions and music and everything, and it's one of those themes. They believe that it's edgy, it's aspirational, it's pushing the envelope, and that's what they're doing with kids. And sex and violence, both of those things, they believe it sells, the younger the better, and that's one of the big things that I think is causing backlash among parents and adults, because they've really just gone so far so fast on that stuff.
On the back of your book is a blurb from Bill McKibben where he goes, there must be a special circle of hell designed for those who came up with the notion of marketing to young kids. And when you discuss subjects like that, that quote really captures the response a lot of people have when you talk about it. We have only a few seconds left. I'm going to try to squeeze in this last caller from line three. Can you make a quick comment, please?
I just was going to argue against the idea that it isn't a conservative liberal thing, because I think Columbine, for example, is the result of that kind of what's going on in this advertising to children, because there was picking on people in an unforgiving way in the playground, and that's one of the things that advertisers exploit.
You know, I think I have to cut that off there. Do you have any quick comment on that, Juliet?
I didn't really understand.
Well, I think it's a broader, I think it's too much to take on in the last 30 seconds of Media Matters, so I'm afraid we're going to have to just stop there. I want to thank you so much, Juliet Shore, for being our guest today on Media Matters. Juliet Shore is the author of the new book, Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. Again, thank you so much for joining us.
I was honored. Thank you.
Of course. And I'll be back 1 week from today, 167 hours with another show. I want to thank Victor Picard, my producer, for doing a great job. And I'll see you all then. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Prairie Boat Works, Champaign; Lincoln Diagnostics Incorporated, Decatur; and Body Work Associates in Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with the high in the lower 40s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the lower 30s and west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain in the afternoon, the high in the lower 40s with north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois, 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at will.uiuc.edu. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.